Thank you for tuning in. You are listening to the Economics for Rebels, the podcast series of the European Society for Ecological Economics. Not too long ago, it was an act of rebellion to pursue economics as if nature mattered. This rebellion continues. This is a podcast dedicated to exploring the economics of just and sustainable transformations. Conversations with and for those who are ready to act on rapid and radical change for people and planet. Welcome to our podcast. I am your host, Alexandra Kovesh, and you are listening to the Economics for Rebels podcast. Ecological economics is a field that historically evolved from discourses of people from many disciplines. Finally, ecologists and economists were in dialogue with each other on how to transform the world to respect planetary boundaries. Today's guest, Clive Spech, argues, however, that the importance of social, political, ethical, and institutional factors is something which ecologists are not trained to detect and economists are trained to neglect. The way forward can only be social ecological economics, where the necessity of human behavioral change is not overlooked. Today's guest is Clive Spech, and we will talk about social ecological economics. Clive is an ecological economist, Chair of Public Policy and Governance Department of Socioeconomics at the Vienna University of Economics and Business in Austria. His main interests are interdisciplinary research on human behavior, environmental values, and the transformation of the world political economy to a more socially and environmentally just system. He is author of over 200 published works in the field of ecological economics. He's editor-in-chief of the journal Environmental Values. Welcome, Clive.
Thanks, Sandra. Thanks for inviting me to your rebellious collective.
You have been working with ecological economics for decades. Should I dare to say, almost from the beginning of the institutionalization of the field? Nonetheless, some time ago, your reflection on ecological economics prompted you to throw in the tag social to ecological economics. Why is that?
Yeah, well, I have been involved since the beginning of the modern eco-economics movement, or however we'd like to call it, field or what have you, or as Inger Rutke has referred to it as this kind of intellectual collective. And I was at the first conference in Washington, D.C., and I gave a plenary actually there jointly with my supervisor, Ralph Darge. So I've been in the field for quite a while. Why the social aspect, right? Why put this up at the front? Well, I could see over time the failure of ecological economics to actually address some of the things that some of its founders had pointed out. So it's often neglected that people like Georgescu Rogan did not just emphasize the need for realism in terms of biophysical reality, but he was also extremely aware of the connection to the social and to the nature of the human mind and the need for any science to understand the way in which humans construct their knowledge, for example, but also the implications of the economic process. You know, Georgescu Rogan's book was on the economic process. It's not just about entropy, energy, and materials. It's also about society and what is a just and ethical society. The failure then that I see in ecological economics, or that I have seen in ecological economics, is that the social is missing. And that this tendency then to adopt implicitly a social theory, which is never discussed, which unfortunately has fallen into the social theory of liberalism and capitalism and neoliberalism. So what you get is an underlying theory about politics and society, which is never discussed, which is implicitly about, well, human beings are selfish. They need to have monetary incentives. We've got to talk about services and capital, and we've got to incentivize people to react. This is a very, very particular social theory, not discussed in ecological economics. So this is a failure, right? The other side of this is that, you know, the missing social theory is also got a missing political analysis. There's no political analysis. So we're told things like, okay, how should ecological economists intervene? Well, we have to get the policymakers on board. We've got to talk to the policymakers. Why? What's the theory behind that? Who are these mythical policymakers that we're supposed to get on board? There's no theory about it. There's no idea of it, right? So you get all sorts of statements coming through. The journal is full of political and policy analysis without any politics and any political and policy analysis. It's absolutely unbelievable and amazing to me. So the social has to be at the front. And I say social, not socio. And I want to emphasize that as well. It's social, because social is the issue. It's not socioeconomics. It's not an appendage to economics of some little add-on or interaction. It is a fundamental aspect of the way in which we should be conducting our science. Of and then I think there's issues around, you know, the failure of the system. So what is the system that we're addressing? You don't even get a discussion about what economics is. So modern economics is about capitalism because the system is capitalist. That means that all of the economics is about capitalism. If we want an alternative system, we better discuss an alternative system, not capitalism. And yet all the economic models are about capitalism, so we never get a discussion of anything else. That's another failure, right? I mean, it's fundamental failure. And then we've got the whole thing about ethics and values, right? The discussion of this is about social, about society. How do we create our society? What do we do? What actions do we undertake? What values do we want in society? These are all issues around the social aspects, how we construct, how we interact with each other and so on. So there's a whole range of things here which are just a big black hole in terms of the ecological economics and what it's doing. And it's just following mainstream economics in this kind of failure to address the social. And then I can get to the philosophy of science aspect, right? And the importance of the social construction of knowledge here and clarifying what that means. Here I can see very clearly in ecological economics failures again. The failures on one side is to believe that we can just have facts, and if we can go out there and collect all the facts, we can objectively collect data, and then this will inform a policy process. Why? Why should just facts suddenly change things? Clearly they don't. We've had 40 years of facts on climate change. It hasn't changed a bloody thing, you know? Look at the policy process, right? So clearly that's a failure. And the facts are not just self-evident, they're clearly constructed. This is the point of social constructionism. But the other side of this is that ecological economists and the degrowth community and many others go to the opposite extreme and then claim there are no facts, that everything is a human construct, that we should be rabid pluralists and accept all information. Is the earth flat or round? Oh, I don't know. Some people believe it's flat. Maybe we should include that in our theories. Let's be pluralists, let's not exclude them. You know, it's absolutely ridiculous stuff I hear from the community, from some of its leaders who I don't need to name because I've written about them. So those are some of the reasons why we put social at the front.
Wow, you have mentioned quite a few. So let's try and talk about bits and pieces what you've mentioned. I think first you mentioned the failure of mainstream economists to see humans as they are in their complexities, basing their idea on homo economicus, the rational, self-interested individual who is only seeking to maximize self-utility. And of course, they also believe that some mystical force behind this picture or behind this image of the human being will finally serve the interest of all humankind. You said it is a failure, and I guess many of ecological economists would actually agree with you, but what is supposed to replace this narrow view of humans in times of the ecological crisis we are experiencing?
Yes, I think, you know, the issue here is again an aspect of what I was touching on in terms of philosophy of science. What are we doing when we're studying? We're studying objects, right? We're looking at the world around us and trying to understand them. The fundamental failure of the mainstream is that it is totally unscientific in this regard. It ignores its object to study. If you look at a human being, you're a human being, I'm a human being, we can do self-reflection. You know, this is a great advantage over physicists. They're not rocks, they can't self-reflect, right? So if we can self-reflect as a human being, I am not a selfish individual. This is not the definition of what I am. But beyond that, the economist's model is not a human. It's not a model of humans or human behavior. What is it? What is it to be homo economicus? It is to do calculations on the basis of an algorithm. What does calculations on the basis of an algorithm, a computer? It's a computer, it's not a human being. There's no choice in their model. There is no choice. It's an absolute fallacy that their model is about choice, because you have no choice. You have to maximize your utility on the basis of an algorithm. Therefore, there is no choice. You do what the maximum tells you. It's a calculation, it's a formula. So for a start, let's take that. The basic is unscientific model. It's not about humans. It's about computers. So what do we do? What is a human being then? What are humans like? Well, humans are vacillating, uncertain. They're conflicted. They have difficult time making decisions. They aspire to be rational, right? So rationality is an aspiration. It's not a definition of a human being. You know, rationality arises with the Enlightenment to counter other worse forms of decision making. It's an aspiration that we should try to rationalize. But that's not the essence of the human being, which is quite often said, you know, the essence of a human being is to be rational. Human beings have lots of other aspects to them, right? They're emotional. They get upset. I get angry. I get outraged at things. This is good. Emotions are good. They're not things to be removed from the human being so that we can all become computers and robots, you know, cyborgs or something, or Mr. Spock or something. You know, this is about humans being conflicted. I mean, Spock is a great character if you look at Star Trek, because he is actually raising exactly what the issue is about being purely rational. Humans are not purely rational. You know, he's half logical and half human, so he has emotions. And emotions are extremely important. I mean, this is what the feminists have pointed out. Decision-making on the basis of emotion is a massive driver. You know, what is it that, why do we do what we do? What are the actions that we undertake? So, you know, to get back to what you were talking about, you know, if you go down this model of trying to understand what a human is, the economists can't understand anything because they don't have a model of humans. So, you know, if we go down and we start to get more complicated about it, and we say, why do humans sacrifice their lives? Is that rational? Why would you sacrifice your life for somebody you don't even know? And yet we've seen this with the COVID pandemic. What are doctors and nurses doing? They're dying for people they've never even met before, right? They're putting their lives on the line. This is irrational, okay? So why do they do it? So how can you understand what humans are if you can't even understand the basic of the daily life we've been living for the last 2 years? You can't explain it. So I would say what we need to do then is to open up this box of the human and start to think about it. What is it? So I've done work on social psychology, and I was very disappointed by the social psychologists and their models. They're a little bit better than the economists because they don't treat humans as computers, but they also don't get a very full model. So they start including things like norms and norms of behavior. Well, that's good, okay? So we start to connect to the fact that we as humans are social beings, not individuals, right? So we aren't individuals. I mean, do you have a mother and father? Of course you do. You're a bloody human being, right? So you're not an individual, are you? You've got a family. I mean, you know, so maybe you lost your family. Maybe your parents are dead, but you did have them. You live in a community. You know, do you go to the shop? Of course you do. You go to the shop. Well, there's human beings there. You're not an individual. You know what I mean? You can't survive as an individual. This is, again, the fallacy. I mean, what they're trying to do in our society to make us individuals, lock us into our little rooms and make us order food from Amazon and whatever, you know, so that we become individualized so you can be controlled. This is the antithesis of being a human. Humans are social. They're social beings. So you've got to have a social aspect into it. So then we talk about, what is our social motivation? What's our community? You know, who do we relate to? So, you know, motivation for a human is also about reflection on what other people think about you. What is the social aspects? Emotion, love, anger, all these sorts of things come into it, right? So a better model of what is human is to think about how humans deal with their daily complex lives. Why do they undertake certain practices? How do they deliberate over what they should do? What is their ethical basis for action, which is something that I've pushed and included into the model, you know, start to understand what is the ethical basis for human motivation. It's not just about automated maximizing things. So we have to get a much more complex model, add in all these different aspects. Look at your object of study and study it for once.
But what happened to economics if we started taking this richness into consideration? It would
economics will change then. Yeah. So economics is a failure, right? It's a total failure as a science. It doesn't care about its object of study and it doesn't look at it. You know, the best things you get are from non-economists. So Kahneman gets the Nobel Prize in economics and he's a cognitive psychologist. He has an extremely narrow theory of humans, but it's better than treating them as computers. So give the man a Nobel Prize in economics. Well done, great. His theory is a 60-year-old theory from psychology. It's not even modern psychology, right? So what happens is that you start looking interdisciplinary. We look across fields. We look at fields and how they understand humans and human behavior. Sociology, the interaction of people in society, pushed out of economics in the late 1800s. And it's something that we have to bring back in. That's, again, the social aspect. Economics changes. We have to understand what is economics. Redefine economics. Economics is not about choice. It's not about individuals. It's about social provisioning. This is how I would define economics. It's a social process. This is, again, as I mentioned with Georgescu Rogan, we're looking at the throughput of materials and energy. These are social decisions about society, about how we distribute, how we provide, and on what basis we do so. Look at needs. What do humans need to be human? Don't make them into computers because it suits your authoritarian dictatorship or your liberal democracy and so on and so forth. Treat humans as humans.
And once you start treating humans as humans and you try to think of what needs they have, what emotions they have, what norms they have, you mentioned norms. This is where institutions also come into the picture, because institutions shape us and we shape the institutions. And a couple of podcasts ago, Arild Batten was our guest, and we talked about the role of institutions. And I guess social ecological economics also places significant emphasis on institutions.
Yeah, of course, it's very important, right? I mean, the institutional aspect. And of course, I'm very familiar with the work of Arild Batten, and I very much like some of the things that he's done in informing the community of ecological economics about institutions. And I think, you know, to start talking about institutions, the first thing you need to do is to clarify what we mean by institutions. Because I think that commonly when you talk about institutions, people think of organizations. And this is not what the work in ecological economics is doing in this area. It's going back to what I call critical institutionalism. And I think things like Arild's defining institutions in terms of conventions, norms, and rules and regulations. Now, these three aspects can then form organizations. But what happens as soon as you start looking at the institutions in these terms is that you understand also the ways in which there are different mechanisms operating for each of those. So the idea that we as agents are powerless within structures is heavily overplayed. Clearly, we can change those institutions, right? So what do we mean? Like convention, what's a convention? A convention is like how you shake hands, right? Well, you can stop shaking hands if you don't want to. It's a very easy convention to change. Of course, it means that in a society that people will think you're a bit strange and you might get ostracized from the society. But some of these conventions could be quite objectionable. So, you know, I live in Austria, I'm living in Vienna. So how do people greet each other on a daily basis, right? So some people will say, Grüß Gott. Well, what is Grüß Gott, right? God greet you. Well, I'm sorry, I'm not a Catholic. I don't believe in God. And why would I go around saying God greet you? I don't want to do it. It's a convention. I don't have to do it. I change it, right? I've already changed an institutional arrangement by not doing it, by refusing to do it, by saying hello instead, right? That's changing one thing, conventions, okay? So you have conventions, norms. Norms in society, the norms of behavior. Can we change those? Are they difficult to change? Well, norms are about social groups and what groups accept and what's affirmed and denied by a group. Well, who is your social group? Who do you hang out with? Do you hang out with jet-setting flyers? Do you hang out with degrowth people who fly but say they shouldn't? Or do you hang out with people who actually hold their values in place and say you shouldn't fly and don't fly? I mean, you know, that's your norm group. So how do you change the other norm groups? Well, they can be changed, right? I mean, look at what's happened Take something as simple as the throughput of material in a household, right? The throughput of material in the household. When I grew up, it all went in the bin and it went to the landfill, or it was dumped in the sea or dumped somewhere. What happens today? It's not a perfect system, but it's changed dramatically. It's now norm. The norm is unacceptable for you to dump everything in the bin. The norm is you should separate, you should recycle, you should do something about your glass, you should separate your household recyclables and so on and so forth. You should compost. This is a big change in norms. It's not to say everybody follows it. It's not to say that all societies do, but it's a massive change in the norms of just dealing with your household waste, right? And that's the success of the environmental movement, we could say. Now,
how are these norms changed?
One example, right? It's one example. There's also the rules and regulations, right? We haven't even got to that. So the rules and the regulations, I would say, they can be the hardest aspect because they're very formalized in terms of the social organizations that we have. So rules and regulations, we think of the legal system, we think of the police, we think of enforcement. You can think of all the ways in which these things are very difficult to change, but they can be challenged. Rules and regulations can also be changed. They can be changed through the formal system, or they can be changed outside of the formal system by challenging the structures that actually enforce them and looking at the mechanisms which maintain these rules and regulations. If they are unjust rules, if they are unjust institutions, then we can change them, right? This is the whole point of rebelling against authority. The grounds on which you decide that this institution is a bad institution and needs to change. So all of these things can change. This is not to say that structure is an easy thing to change or it changes us. Social structure I'm talking about here. Social structure can take generations to change, right? And it's not an easy thing to change. So if you look at the social structure of capitalism, well, a lot of people have been trying to change that for a long time and they failed, right? We've still got capitalism. So it's not to say in its very many forms, it's not to say that it's easy or that things happen quickly, but it's also not to say just because you're inside a structure and also reproducing that structure, we should remember. So even like degrowth people reproduce the structure of capitalism, they go to the market, they buy stuff, they get on, you know, they partake of transport systems, whether it's flying or trains or whatever, which are part of the system. Right, privatized companies, fossil fuel industry, the military industrial complex that has designed the computers that we're using, so on and so forth, right? So we're engaged in practices which we might find objectionable and want to change, but we're also within structure and you can't change everything in the structure very easily. So it takes
time. How can you intervene? Where can you intervene?
You can intervene at every single level. All the time. You can intervene from, as I said, from the very simple thing of changing your daily practices yourself, all the way through to changing the society, right? I'm in an institute of multi-level governance. The whole point of multi-level governance is there are multiple levels of governance, right? It's not just about voting in, in a useless, undemocratic system with a vote once every 3 or 5 years, which never gets counted and taken into account. That's the worst aspect of it. To call that democracy is a farce, really. And it's about participation. It's about, you can change your daily practices. You can go on demonstrations. You can be politically active. You can change what you write. You can change what you read. You can change who you talk to. You can change how you talk to people. There are hundreds of things that you can do as an individual. Engage, get solidarity. Help other people, discuss things, debate things, make people feel morally uncomfortable about their wrong actions. You know, I think this is fine. Why not? There's so many things that you can do. This idea, we can't do anything, it's the structure. The worst of it is, right, I mean, I had a discussion recently, or communication recently, with somebody who is held up highly in degrowth, and they were arguing that they couldn't stop flying, or they couldn't not engage in various other activities because of the structure. Now, this person is meant to be radical on the left, right? The structure is preventing me from doing what I should do. I think this is bullshit, quite honestly. It's an excuse not to take action. Of course, we're none of us perfect. We can't change everything in our lives. I'm not saying that. But to start using arguments about structure preventing you, if the structure is there and you recognize it and you think it's the wrong thing and you're undertaking the wrong actions, then study it scientifically and work out the mechanism by which you can change it. That's the science, that's social ecological economics. understand the mechanisms. Why is that structure there? What supports the structure? What are the mechanisms supporting it? What are the mechanisms preventing it from being changed? How can I create mechanisms to overthrow it and change it? That's the science.
And I guess this has a lot to do with social dialogue, because you can't really change things without having some kind of social dialogue. And behind social dialogue, you always have values and what you believe in, and we hardly ever hear strong social dialogue on values and ethics and philosophical considerations. Even though, as you have written many times, there's ethics and values behind everything, every policy action, every social action, every economic action, there are values. And there have been some philosophical debates, for example, around price gouging or around handling the bank bailout. These were the topics where you could actually hear in wider context ethical and philosophical debates. But they also faded away. How can you initiate these debates? Why do we actually need them? And what is the role of ethics in social ecological economics?
Okay, so I think, you know, what you're touching on, clearly, what is ethics, we could start with? You know, what do we mean when we discuss something like ethics? Ethics is about our practices and actions in society, what we think is right and wrong. So ethics is never absent. It's continuously with us. Everything we do on a daily basis is an action, a practice. Why do we think it's right to do this? Why do we think it's wrong to do something else? That is ethics. So ethics is about how we rationalize this, how we think about it, how we consider it. So you're quite right. I would say that all these policy debates and discussions are ethical, right? They have an ethical aspect to them because they're actually about confirming why we think things are right and wrong. Is there a lack of discussion here about the moral philosophy and the ethical aspect of it? Clearly there is, because there's a dominant hegemonic discourse, right, in society. It's a hegemony, Gramsci's term, for the power structure and how the power structure maintains power. The media, how does the media discuss things? It discusses them in terms of very narrow set of ethical criteria, which is consequentialism, and a very narrow set of consequences it looks at as well, quite often monetary. So, you know, why do they support the neoclassical economists and the mainstream economists who, as I've said, have a totally unscientific, irrelevant theory that doesn't address their object of study? The reason they support them is because it's purely rhetorical, because it supports what they want, which is to talk about the consequences in terms of wealth, which is the wealth for the elite at the end of the day. So you've got a continuous ethical discussion going on. It's just implicit, right? And we're not debating this. Of course, as you say, it comes up in the media now and again when it's forced to. Ethical debates over COVID. Should every student in my university be forced to have a vaccine? I was discussing in the corridor just yesterday with a professor. You know, I find this objectionable. And I told him it's not a political decision, it's ethical. It's an ethical decision. You know, and people like stand back, oh, ethics, oh, God, oh, what's that about? You know, this is pathetic, quite honestly, for an educated man to not even understand that this is an ethical debate. And then to say, oh, it's all about solutions. We've got to find a solution. This is absolute, you know, this is really, really poor thinking. So yes, the level of which we're discussing, and we're discussing ethics and the way we should act, the way that we should live our lives, is extremely poor, because we're being told to live our lives in a certain way, continuously reinforced through the media. Buy stuff, consume. You'll be happy if you consume more. Get the latest this, get the latest that. That's how you should act in our society. Or look at the, you know, I love these kind of things, like look at things like the Dasgupta report, you know, or Stern's report, or these kinds of things. What is their ethical criteria? So these guys claim to be ethical, and then they have an extremely narrow model of ethics. And in Dasgupta's report, which came out earlier this year, is amazing to me. His role model is bankers and financiers. Now, who in the world would hold bankers and financiers up as your ethical role model? I mean, you know, really, come on. Even Keynes 100 years ago pointed out that these people were motivated by the worst and most objectionable psychosis around, love of money and love of money for itself. You know, if that's your ethical criteria, then I would say you're pretty unethical. So these are the debates that you need to have. So, you know, at the heart of eco-economics, of social eco-economics, of degrowth, of the post-growth, is how we should live our lives. That's an ethical challenge. How should we live? On what basis should we make our decisions? And this should not be confused with religion, right? So quite often, if you say moral, people immediately think, oh, you're talking about religion. No, we're not talking about religion, because we're talking about here rationalizing and evaluating on terms of rational choices about what on what basis do I make my decisions. We're not appealing to God. We're not concerned about whether I'm going to heaven or hell if I'm a Christian, or whether I'm a Buddhist, that I'm going to either be enlightened or be on the eternal circle of suffering. You know, that's the concern for religious people. That's not my concern. So my concern is about how I live my life and on what basis I do so. And I have a conscience and I reflect upon it. You know, Adam Smith, who is quite often reduced down to The Wealth of Nations, his main book was not The Wealth of Nations. It was called The Moral Sentiments. He revised it six times. He spent more time on that book than he ever spent on The Wealth of Nations. And what are The Moral Sentiments about? It's how to live a moral life. It's your reflection upon yourself, right? The spectator, the person who is you, looking upon you, thinking about you and why you do things. Who are you? Why do you live your life?
On the other hand, I guess many would argue that there is a moral philosophy behind current mainstream economics, and it's utilitarianism.
I mean, of course, there is a very, and if you take something like Dasgupta report or you take Stern's report, they will have their mathematical models with their utilitarian U's and their little symbols and so on and so forth. Whether they're really following that as an ethical system in their daily lives, I would say no, they're not, because if they were, they would be particularly objectionable people, and they would actually end up being like the calculating machines, and they wouldn't be thinking and debating. The fact that the people have to actually debate and discuss their ethical criteria shows that there are alternative debatable issues. There's value conflicts. I mean, this is, you know, like John O'Neill has pointed out for our community very much, the incommensurability issues. So how do we make decisions when we have value conflicts? We face value conflicts every day, right? And multiple value conflicts, the old things are, do you go and see your mother or do you go to class? Do you go and see your sick friend or you know, do you go shopping or whatever? I don't know. It could be anything, right? I mean, but there's so many value conflicts in our daily basis about how we decide what we're doing. But we deal with these value conflicts. Well, the moral issue is about how we deal with them and why we think what we've done is right, or, and when we fail, why we think it's wrong. And that's the issue, I think, that is at the heart of this is actually then discussing this. So yes, I've pointed out that, you know, economics is not a vacuous whole in terms of its moral philosophy. It has got a moral philosophy, which it falls back on. It falls back on, as you point out, utilitarianism primarily, and a very narrow form of utilitarianism. In modern economics, it's preference utilitarian. So it's the preferences that count. It's not Benthamite. It's not Bentham's the greatest good for the greatest number, which has its own problems. It's actually a very narrow form, which is individualistic again. So you go down to the individual and you say, whatever you prefer, that's good. Well, that's a totally vacuous philosophy, right? Why do you prefer what you prefer? It tells you absolutely nothing about the individual. Oh, I prefer planetary destruction to strawberry flavored ice creams. Oh, great. Well, whatever. You know, I mean, it's absolutely useless. It doesn't tell you anything. If I tell you that my choice between two flavors of ice cream is my preference, I've told you nothing. Absolutely nothing.
But when you face a clash of values, that's when politics come in, I guess.
you somehow have to find a way of navigating through these clashes in needs, in interests, in values, and so on.
So this would be, again, so if we're talking about conflict, value conflicts, right, this is where we've brought in ideas of deliberation. And in political theory, of course, deliberation in society is seen as one of the ways in which you can actually help to start addressing value conflicts, open discourse in society. But of course, deliberation also has its problems. We spent a lot of time in the European society 20 years ago working on deliberation, deliberative democracy, deliberative approaches. I advocated that sometimes, you know, deliberative monetary valuation, if you're going to use monetary valuation, then deliberate over it, you know, discuss and debate about what it is and have different forms of institutions that can deliberate in different ways. You know, so you have groups deliberating, but these are all contextual and about the context in which the decision is being made. And of course, that is about power and power relations. So of course, do we always want to deliberate? Well, no, we don't always want to deliberate. If you have an authoritarian dictator or some dickhead like Trump, then you don't want to deliberate with these people because they're absolute assholes, right? I mean, they can't deliberate. They're not interested in deliberating. They're not rational, right?
So yes, but on the other hand,
these people, you have to challenge them. You have to look at the mechanisms that support them and why are they in power in the first place?
Yes, so but there are millions of people behind these people. So,
So
you have to deliberate. You have to take those interests and values into account as well.
Totally, you do. I totally agree with that, right? So in the recent conference of the International European Society in Degrowth in Manchester, I was pointing out exactly this, that, you know, what are called in the media poor white trash, which is the major supporters for someone like Trump. Right, these people are in a particular situation, right? So why are they doing what they're doing? You know, I lived in Wyoming. I know many people who are probably voting for Trump, who I spent years with when I was doing my PhD in Wyoming, and I can understand the reasons that they are behind what they're doing, their insecurities, their fears, the way that they are constructed into hatred and hatred of the other, right? And these are serious issues to be addressed in society. Why are these people in the situation they're in? Fear and hatred is, of course, rife in society, and it's actually being used, right? So we do live in a military-industrial complex. We live in a militarized society. I mean, you know, in Hungary, you have Orbán, and he creates fear and hatred of the other. You know, we've got Bolsonaro, we've got Trump, we've got Bojo in England. You know, I mean, these guys are all over the place creating their fear and hatred and to get support. Amongst, you know, men, primarily middle-aged men who have lost direction, who are disempowered by modernity, who have meaningless jobs, or as Graeber called them, bullshit jobs, you know, and what's their identity? What's their self-identity? Their self-identity is a car and a gun. And if you try and take their car and a gun away from them, they have no identity at all. And so this is the failure in society. This is a structural issue. So how do you deliberate with somebody who is 40 or 50 years old, whose self-identity is a car and a gun? You know, that's a real problem.
How can you get to these people? How can you get to policymakers who are in power currently and not in favor of deliberations?
Yeah, so I think that you've got to, again, I come back to looking at the mechanism. So the people who are in power are obviously supported by a whole range of structures, okay? So what are the structures that are supporting them? What are the mechanisms that reinforce them? So we know what many of these things are. The media, control of the media, they're very good at that. Co-optation of the discourse, maintaining a discourse, taking over the language of anybody who challenges them. You know, this is why I've talked about using Gramsci's term passive revolutions. So, you know, the failure of the environmental movement is that it's co-opted into the system. So rather than challenge these people when given a chance to take power, what people do is they actually join with them because they want a seat at the table. We've seen this repeatedly. You know, look at the World Wildlife Fund, not that that was ever a very radical organization, or you could take Greenpeace, which was more radical at one time in the 70s. And you see these people sitting down at the table with the capitalists and the corporations and the big power players to talk about how they can financialize nature and commodify it and buy and sell it, right? Well, this is a total failure. So they've identified some of the mechanisms, they got to the table and they've been co-opted. So, you know, there are many mechanisms here. Academia, for example, right? We should not underestimate the power of academia or ideas. Why do these people, all of them, attack the universities, attack the professors, attack freedom of speech, try to restrict freedom of speech, try to stop people talking? Because there is power in words, there are power in ideas, there is power in academia. And we shouldn't underestimate this. You know, how do things change? Well, you know, it's not an easy question to answer. You know, as I was saying earlier, structure can take time to change. It may take generations, but it can also happen very quickly and very surprisingly. You know, the fall of totalitarian dictators, which happens overnight sometimes. And people are like amazed. Well, where do they go? What happened? You know, the fall of the Berlin Wall. These kinds of things that can happen very quickly, that people can be displaced or out of power. Understanding how they happen and what can make these things change. You know, this is why the rule of law is important. This is why constitutions are important in our Western societies, because they maintain the ability to counter and to stop totalitarian dictators, fascists, Nazis taking over, objectionable societies from being created. The United States almost became a totalitarian dictatorship. You know, if those guys had started pulling their triggers and murdered the Senate, what would we have had? You would have had, you know, you'd have Trump as a new Hitler. That's what you'd have had. It came very close. It's on the brink. It's still on the edge. What are the Republicans doing today? Denying exactly what happened, denying the truth, spreading lies. You know, these are people who are totally objectionable, but they're in power. So the media is behind them. They have money, but they're exposed. They're exposed very clearly. We know these things, right? So they should be discussed. You know, why does so few people call Trump a Nazi or a fascist? It's amazing. The media hardly ever uses the term. A few people have said it. A few people have written about it. But I'm talking scientifically in political science terms, not as a derogatory term. Of course, I'd love to use it as a derogatory term as well. But the fact is that if you look at it scientifically, how do we define what is a fascist? And you look at what Trump stands for, he's very clearly a fascist, right? He's undemocratic. He uses power. He's totally in favor of using military, the police. He doesn't believe in science. He doesn't believe in facts. He doesn't believe in truth or information. He just uses, I mean, all these are traits of fascism defined back in the 1930s by political scientists, you know, when they're looking at Mussolini and Hitler and what their ideology and their movements were about.
What do you think is the role of social movements in overthrowing dominant discourses or structures or processes?
Yeah, you know, clearly social movements can be very important. I would say, you know, so why do we have so many social movements today is an interesting question. And it's clearly because democracy fails, or what we call our democracies of various sorts are failing. You only need a social movement, really, because you're representing a group that is disenfranchised and feels that there's injustice in the world about them, whether it's you know, as we were talking about, the poor white trash creating their social movements, or it's the left wing or the Greens or whoever. These are many groups in society who feel they have no place to express their voice. So the system is failing. Now, then you get to an interesting question is, what is a social group for? Why? What legitimates a social group? Why has it got, you know, legitimacy, and what role should it play? Well, I think that the social movements have got a role, and they are necessary because there are injustices in the world, and there are the kind of power structures that we were just discussing, and there are people around who are basically subverting the power relationships and subverting what's, you know, just and ethical society. So social movements are extremely important. And when there are injustices in the world, then you need social movements to actually address them and to raise them and to change debates and to actually challenge the power structures. So again, we could see the social movements have a role to play. Now, the interesting question then is to actually look at the social movements, right? So my colleague Viviana Asara has been working on this for many years and looking at different social movements. What is a success and a failure? What is the rightful action for a social movement to take? And what would be a wrong action? And many of the social movements that we're concerned about on the environmental side are pacifist, right? So this is a very strong aspect of what they would advocate, is that you shouldn't undertake violent action, that you should undertake peaceful action, civil action, because then you face violence from the police, like we had in Vienna just 2 years ago. And I was there on the demonstrations, and to see the police actually, beating up people and violating the law, right? And it's actually recorded, but the recordings go nowhere, the system doesn't react. Or you've got what's going on in France now, where the social movements, you're not allowed to video the police anymore. They don't want to see the evidence of the failures of what's going on, but the social movements have to do that. From Amnesty International all the way through to the more radical Sea Shepherd and so on, they all have a role to play because there are injustices in society and there are failures to address. It's one set of mechanisms, I would say, again, a counter mechanism to the power structure. And then, as I argued in the Manchester conference, you have to think about how activism and academia then unite. And social movements need theory, right? So this idea that you can just be an activist and you can join a social movement. And like I heard so much rubbish coming from, unfortunately, from Extinction Rebellion people, especially in our climate camp here, when we had some UK Extinction Rebellion people come 3 years ago. And I'm sorry that they were really poor on their kind of, we don't need theory, we're all beyond that. Oh, you're an old white professor, we don't need to listen to you, blah, 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 all this kind of rubbish. And at the end of the day, of course they have a theory, right? It may be a very bad theory and it doesn't work. Well, that's the problem. And they're not prepared to discuss it. So what is their idea of how they're going to change society? What is their idea of the political structure? Well, is this idea that we should just create scientific information and push it through, is that adequate for us to actually get anywhere? Clearly not. Is getting all your supporters arrested and put on the blacklist of the police as terrorists, is that going to change society? Clearly not. They've got to have a theory that's better than that if they're going to go anywhere. They have theories, otherwise they wouldn't be on the streets. They believe that their actions will actually have a causal effect. That's a causal relationship. If you believe in a causal relationship, then you're already a scientist. That's a theory, right? They've got to have a causal explanation for why they're doing what they do. Why do they put their bodies on the line? Why do they do lots of very brave things? Because they think it's going to have an impact, right? It's going to have an effect, and they are the cause. So that's a theory. So you have to link these things up. So social movements, I think, have to link to academia, and the academia has a moral duty to be activists.
To close out this episode, I'm asking you the question I ask all my guests. What is your rebellion?
Yeah, that's a very individualist kind of thing, isn't it? It's quite interesting. So my rebellion. Because the rebellion, the whole of your podcast is quite interesting as well, I think, in terms of the title, because it's already phrased as a rebellion against economics, right? Mainstream economics is meant here. Okay, so clearly, at one level, you could say all ecological economists of any sort, or certainly the social ones, should understand that they're in a rebellion already. They're rebelling against economics as it's taught and the hegemony of economics. And so we should actually say, what is it to rebel? What is a rebellion? So the word rebellion goes back to the opposition in the 1600s, really, to objectionable systems of authority. So you have these systems of law or governance where there are people in power who believe that they have the right of God on their side in the 1600s. And then you get people like Hobbes and Locke raising issues about when is it right for us to rebel against somebody who has been given power by God, and coming up with theories about when it's just to have a rebellion. And then you get things like the French Revolution and the American Revolutions, which use this kind of thing. But also in the English Revolution, you've got people rebelling. What are they rebelling against? They're rebelling against authoritarianism, against socially unjust social structures. And this is therefore what every ecological economist, is a social economist, as I say, should recognize, that they're in a rebellion. If they don't recognize that, then I'm afraid that their theories are very poor, because they don't understand what they're doing in their work. So they're opposing a power structure. The power structure is economic. So at one level, we've got that, right? So you could say, what's my part in the rebellion? Is I'm actually a social ecological economist, and social ecological economics is part of the rebellion, right? It's the rebellion against economics. But beyond that, we can start to think more generally about what it is, and we've been discussing in this talk, about the structures in society, the things that are unjust, recognizing injustice in society, whether it's racism or sexism or discrimination or hatred of the other or fear or whatever. So recognizing these things, and the people who actually push lies on about others and about society, lies about climate, lies about the science and so on. So I think another rebellion for me is actually to make sure that you get rid of pseudoscience, rebel against pseudoscience, against the lies, you know, and promote good science. And I see an awful lot of things to rebel against, both in terms of the rubbish that I've discussed in terms of the economics and its lack of scientific credibility, but also, unfortunately, on the side of people in the post-growth, degrowth, and other communities who also do extremely poor science. You know, I had a debate earlier this year with Kate Raworth about her donut economics. I think the donut economics is absolute rubbish. It's totally unscientific. You know, very nice for people to have if you want to go running around with simple diagrams and portray things. But if you just connect the dots between what she claims at the beginning of her book with Georgescu, Rogan, and quoting Marx, and then you trace that through to agnosticism about growth, doesn't make sense, right? There's no link up at all. So I would rebel against that as well. I would rebel against bad pseudoscience. People who claim they're doing science, that they claim that they're actually creating theories when they're not, right? So there's plenty to rebel against in the academia and the academy, but the society is also. So injustice in society. You know, I really dislike, I get angry and outraged by what goes on in our society. And to see the injustices, to see the funding of the military, to see the overpowering technologies, the high tech that are forced onto us, to see the way that things are pushed undemocratically into our lives, to see the structures being taken over and controlled by corporations. Corporations are an undemocratic institution that is dominating our world economy and our world systems. To see the rich people flying into space with their billions while people starve, you know, and then getting praised by the media and God knows what. I mean, this outrages me. These are things to rebel against. There's so much to rebel against. Where would we stop? You know, I mean, there's tons of things I could rebel against, I think, from start to finish. So, you know, it's not a personal rebellion. It's a community. It's a solidarity movement, though. We're in this together. There's no point in being one rebel, as Che Guevara found out. You've got to be part of the collective. Don't go into the jungle on your own and try and fight an army. You'll be dead.
Well, thank you very much, Clive. And thanks to all of you for spending time with us. Stay tuned with us for our next episode. Bye, Clive.
Bye. Thanks very much, Sandra.
Thank you for listening to the podcast series of the European Society for Ecological Economics. If you like the conversation and your work is related to ecological economics in any discipline, consider becoming a member of our society to stay connected. If you are ready to discuss the topic, join our Facebook group called European Society for Ecological Economics.